listening to the Miles to Go podcast, the go-to source for travel tips, news, and reviews you can't afford to miss. Now, here's your host, travel expert Ed Pizza.
Welcome back to another episode of the Miles to Go podcast, where we bring you the latest travel news, tips, and tricks each week to help you save money and travel better. It was really great to have everybody come on the show last week and congratulate me, hearing from my friends about our one-year anniversary on Miles to Go, and I am eager to jump in to year number two. We have a bit of a long segment to start out the show because we've got a special topic to discuss, the death of the biggest commercial airplane I've ever been on, the A380. News came out last week that the program is officially ending, and we've got Seth Miller back on from PAXX.Aero to talk about why it happened and what you can expect as a passenger in the future. After that, we've got Jen back for her deal segment, and we're talking about the most recent Hyatt promo, which for the first time in a while is one of those promotions that you might actually think about switching some of your business for. It really depends on your circumstances, and we'll definitely dig into that in more detail. You'll also hear about our giveaway this week. We're giving away a pair of travel jeans from Bluffwork, so stay tuned for that in one of the commercial breaks. In the meantime, I would love it if you'd share the show with a friend. That helps us grow the show each and every week. Also, make sure that you subscribe to the show so you get our new episodes for free as soon as they're available each week. It's easy to do whether you're listening in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever podcasts are found. And if you have a moment, we'd love it if you'd leave us a rating and a comment on the podcast. Be sure to drop us a line and let us know who we should have on for future episodes and what questions we can help you answer. You can email me at ed@pizzainmotion.com and find me on all the social media places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. With all that housekeeping aside, we're going to get over to my conversation with Seth about the Airbus A380. Back on the Miles to Go podcast to talk about the biggest commercial airplane I've ever been on, and it's sad but expected demise. And if we're talking about airplanes and passenger experience, it's got to be Seth from PAXX.Aero. Seth, thanks for being back on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me once again.
Yeah, I said earlier in our 1 year episode that I think you are the second most frequent guest on the show behind Jen, who does the deal segment. So you have that ignominious distinction. Congratulations.
Thank you. And I guess the deal segment sounds like it's valuable. Otherwise I'd kneecap her so I could take the lead.
Jen, watch out if you're out there. Seth is gunning for your position.
Also, I suppose if I did that, she'd just have more time to record because she couldn't walk. I don't know. Is that defeating the purpose?
In the immortal words of Seth, details.
Well played.
So I'd like to say that I was surprised and not surprised at the same time with the A380 thing, only because they went through so many machinations to get Emirates to book this order. And, Emirates finally said, all right, fine, we're going to add a bunch more frames and it's going to keep the line rolling for another, 8 to 10 years. And I understand that there, certainly have been some regressions from promises since then, but surprised, not surprised that it's dying today. And I'm sure you'll tell me why I shouldn't be surprised.
I will agree with you that it was a little surprising in the end that deal fell through. But at the time it was announced, they also made it clear that there were still questions about the engines. So ultimately, this came down to Emirates and Rolls-Royce could not agree on details around the engines. And with no engines, planes don't fly. So that's a big part of it. But, I think that there was always a little bit of skepticism when the deal came out that something new would happen with the engines. Emirates really wanted a more efficient engine to lower its per passenger cost to make these planes, more affordable to operate, more profitable for the business.
Yeah.
And everything Airbus did was about adding more seats. So in both cases, you get to a lower cost per passenger. But Emirates didn't necessarily want additional capacity. They wanted the overall aircraft just to be cheaper.
Right, right.
And so, the engine thing, it was always, they wanted a Neo, right? Is essentially what it comes down to, and which a new engine option. And Rolls-Royce wasn't going to make new engines for 40 aircraft. And no one else wanted to buy the plane. So, there was maybe a couple dozen other outstanding orders at the time. I think Amadeo, which is a leasing company, had 20. ANA has its three that it's going to take. Qantas had a couple that it's now officially canceled. Like, there just weren't that many other orders out there. So those all could have converted to Neo also, but it still wasn't enough to get Rolls-Royce off the couch, so to speak. And in the end of the day, like, all those conversations, all those things back and forth, even if some of the things like a new winglet to improve efficiency, that doesn't add more seats, but, you know, that was a 0.5% or 1% efficiency, not 4 or 5%,
for sure,
like a new engine would give them. And at the end of the day, I think the outgoing CEO of Airbus, during their sort of media briefing, they announced this as part of their annual earnings call, our annual report earnings sort of event. And it was actually a huge media event. They fly a bunch of media into Toulouse to do it. I was not invited, but I was happened to be in Europe and awake. So I was watching it real time. They stream it online as well. And Tom Enders, who's the outgoing CEO, basically said, and I'm reading this now, a paraphrased quote that I did during this thing live was, "We had no other choice. If you have a product that nobody wants anymore that you have to sell below production costs, you have to stop it." And it really became a fight between the passion and the emotion behind it versus the very, very real practical fact of the matter, which is the damn thing was losing money and they couldn't afford to do it anymore.
For sure. And it's interesting that, when I first heard about the Airbus A380, which goes back, probably just about 20 years ago now to when it was announced.
Yeah. Yep.
It was one of those things where I don't want to have revisionist history. Don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those things where I felt like at the time, like, wow, that's a really cool idea. I'd love to fly on a plane that's a true double decker. I'm not sure I see the population boom that they're talking about. And, you know, given maybe we'll see it 20 years from now, but I still don't see that it doesn't feel like we're going to have that many more people traveling that the right solution is a double decker, as opposed to more frequencies.
Well, and I think what you hit, and I think what you hit is the right solution, right? And so that's the key. If you look at the numbers from IATA, if you look at the numbers from Airbus, if you look at the numbers from Boeing, if you look at the numbers from almost any source, they will say passenger traffic is increasing dramatically. It's going to increase dramatically. It already is increasing dramatically.
Yeah.
What Airbus bet on was massive growth of passengers on traditional hub and spoke airlines. And that was for the 380. The 380 was supposed to be the airplane for Sydney, the airplane for Heathrow, the airplane for Narita, the airplane in theory for Mexico City in some ways, although I think the altitude there would have given them some troubles performance-wise. But right, the whole thing comes down to these are airports that are capacity-limited, slot-limited, chock-a-block full. You can't get more slots, but you still want to grow your operation. So the only way to grow is to get bigger planes. And Airbus looked at them and said, we've got a bigger plane. It'll fit more or less at the same gates. It'll fit more or less on the same runways and taxiways. And I say more or less because a lot of airports invested a lot of money in putting in new gates and new taxiways and a lot of things to make these planes accessible to their airports. But you know, JFK is another one. And if you look at where the plane is popular, it is JFK. It is Heathrow. Dubai happens to be very, very slot controlled. I'm not sure if it's technically slot controlled or not, but it's definitely running at capacity for DXB. And they've got a huge new field desk down the road that no one wants to use. So, oops.
Right.
But you've got all of those. And those airlines, to a small extent, grew and used this 380 to grow their operations. But what really happened is you had airlines overflying the hubs. And so, you know, at Narita, United has de-hubbed it.
Right.
Delta has de-hubbed it. American never really hubbed it. So, right, I mean, ANA and obviously JAL are still there. And ANA is taking a three of them, but not because it wants to, sort of because that was a necessary evil in getting a bunch of extra slots at Haneda. And so they ended up with this situation where Narita is no longer actually competitive for slots. And that part of that comes from Haneda opening up. So, right, that's a geopolitical thing that changed. Heathrow has not opened up. Maybe we'll get a third runway before you and I are dead, but maybe not. And in the meantime, instead of growing huge traffic there, what you're seeing is people are either overflying London, using alternate airports in London, right? Some additional long-haul traffic moved to Gatwick. Things are shifting around, and a lot of the international travel is actually overflying London now instead. And so the growth is happening. It's just not happening at hub-and-spoke airports and hub-and-spoke airlines at quite the same clip and in quite the same way.
For sure. And it's interesting too, because, you know, in my day job, we look at startups, you know, invest in them quite frequently. And one of the things that I see a lot are folks that are working on, you know, hydroponic gardens, grow your own vegetables, things like that. And in the belief that we're moving to a culture where, you know, lots of high rises, you'll grow produce on your balcony or on the roof or, you know, whatever. And, again, like I do see things like that coming down the pike, but I think unless you have that sort of explosive growth in London, it's unlikely that you're going to have a lot more airports that could support that sort of double-decker plane. And I use London just as an example. But I mean, you say like some of these airports,
yeah,
you know, Gatwick, you know, takes some of the traffic elsewhere as opposed to, you know, Heathrow getting bigger. And then, you know, in the surrounding areas, you know, that they haven't seen necessarily the population growth maybe in the heart of London. And I haven't looked at these numbers as opposed to seeing sprawl. And you know, I think our upcoming flight out of Peen Field in Seattle is a good example of, you know, sprawl to the north of the existing Seattle Tacoma airport means that instead of people wanting to drive through, you know, an hour and a half of traffic, they're just going to go out of the smaller Peen Field and however many daily flights they're going to have there are just not going to go to Seattle Tacoma. They're just going to go out of Peen Field.
Yeah, it's 24 and is the number of daily flights there that are going to be approved, just so you know. But the, you know, and part of it also is like the London growth, the Tokyo growth, a lot of this predicted growth wasn't necessarily people going to those cities or not all people going to those cities. A lot of it was also the connections. So it's not just that London didn't grow fast enough to support, you know, huge growth in 380s, but part of it also is, though, as you say, the sprawl, not all the offices or not all the vacationers, right? Not everybody is going to downtown. And some of the people are, instead of connecting at Heathrow, connecting at Gatwick. Some of the people are, or you're displacing the O&D traffic, the people who do live in London. So instead of schlepping down to Heathrow for the BA flight, they have a better option from Stansted or, you know, any of the other smaller airports. London as a city has like 6 airports, I think.
Right.
And so, and it depends on how far out you live and what you actually count like is, but whatever, there's tons of choices. So even if you don't get long haul service from Stansted, you do get more regional service from Stansted. And so BA scales back or doesn't pull as much traffic growth for the regional stuff. And so that doesn't feed the long haul stuff. So they don't need the 380s necessarily, but traffic through the London general area could still be growing.
Could be. And I think, you know, you talk about traffic between the two continents, you know, between North America and Europe is growing. But I think interestingly enough, and I'm not saying I'm the average customer, just, you know, taking my own examples. Sure. Back in the day, you know, when we went to Europe as a family, we connected in London. That was how we got there. And I would say the first, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 8, you know, some significant number, you know, probably not quite 10 or 15 trips were all through Heathrow. I think there was one through Gatwick. And now I was trying to remember the last time I'd been through Heathrow as you and I were talking. It's not that I wouldn't connect, but when I have the option, I'm choosing to connect in Frankfurt or Vienna or Munich because they're the flights are longer, so I get a little bit longer to sleep from the East Coast. And I'm avoiding, maybe it's just my own, you know, bad memories of Heathrow, but I'm avoiding what I believe is a harder airport to get through than say a Munich or a Vienna. You know, Frankfurt's a little bit complicated as well, but you know, my travel is diversified in that I probably use London for 10% or less of my European trips now from a connecting standpoint. I'm still going to Europe the same number of times, maybe more.
Yeah. And I think that's a part of that is there is more service. When you started taking those family trips, I'm going to guess Austrian didn't fly to Dulles.
Yeah.
And now it does, right? Lufthansa maybe only had.
They probably didn't.
Lufthansa probably only had Frankfurt service and not Munich, or only had one a day instead of two. Like, so the traffic is growing. And I would guess that BA probably always had the 3 that I think they still have to Dulles. Maybe it's 4 if there's a morning flight, I forget. But like, you know,
there's no morning. Or I don't think there's a morning right now, but they've sort of gone back and forth between two and three is sort of like the norm.
And to be fair, BA has used the 380 on the Dulles route. I took it. Like, I know that one existed. It was last March, maybe, because I flew it. And so sometimes there is that demand and they can, you know, it's interesting the way the airlines balance their configurations. We talk about just, you know, the total volume of passengers and people moving, but it's not, you know, not all passengers are created equal. And this is not supposed to be some, you know, classist thing necessarily, but, you know, I don't want to get Animal Farm on you, but at some level, like the airline demand has to be attuned, or the airline supply has to be attuned to which types of passengers are flying. And like, you know, Lufthansa has both the 747-8 and the A380. Both are three class of service airplanes, or four class now, because they've added premium economy, and both take about the same amount of space and cost close enough to the same to fly, you know, per passenger. But the 747-8 has way more premium seats relative to the total number than the 380. And so what you'll see is the 748, they use for premium heavy time of year for, you know, bigger markets. And the 380 subs in when they need more economy seats. And so Frankfurt to Miami gets a 380 in the winter, because the Europeans are flocking to South Beach in the winter. And in the summer, it gets downgauged, or historically it has. And maybe it's a 346, maybe it's a 748. You know, they swap it around, and so that you're getting still the large number of premium seats, but fewer economy seats, and the ratio shifts. And they get higher yields from the planes doing that. I mean, British Airways puts the 380 and the 747 into South Africa on a regular basis. But it switches them up depending on, again, seasonal needs and where the high season is and where peak demand is. Los Angeles for British Airways was a 380 market for a while. It was two or three flights a day, and they were all 380s at one point. That was actually the first intercontinental route where they put the 380, because I was on that flight too. And they made a big deal about converting LA to be an all 380 route. And now it comes and goes. Right, they switch it around as they fit. Right. And I think part of, again, it comes down to sort of not just is there demand for people traveling from London to LA, is there people or demand even from, you know, sort of Europe and India to LA, all of which could go via London, but what the overall demand is into LA and how many different places now can you connect to get to LA? And it's way more than it was even 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh, for sure.
So. And way, way more than it was 20 years ago. So, I mean, the market really, really has changed since the 380 came out. And it's not, you know, going sort of coming, trying to bring this back full circle to where we started the conversation this morning or earlier today. I don't know what time it is or where I am anymore. You know, it's not necessarily that we haven't seen the growth in passenger count. It's just that where they're growing and who they are and what they're looking for has adjusted. And it's not, it turns out, what Airbus thought was going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think there's two thoughts that I'd close with. First is that you may not have as many appearances on the podcast as Jen has, but I do believe that's the first George Orwell reference of the podcast. So I'm going to go ahead and mark that down. I was actually talking about Animal.
I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry. I fumbled through remembering the name of the book while I was monologuing there, but I got there eventually.
You did. And it's funny because my wife and I were literally just having a conversation about George Orwell a couple weeks ago based on a podcast that she was listening to. So it's very topical. The other thing, I don't know that the data set exists, but I'll leave it with, you know, if there was somebody who would know where the data set existed and would put the numbers together, it's you. I would be insanely curious if you looked across all departures for the A380, what the actual fill rate was on the plane for
load factor.
Load factor. Thank you. Having one of those mornings where words won't spit out of my head, but you know what the actual load factor was. Cause as you say, like there's variability on maybe they want more premium seats, maybe they want more economy,
sure.
But how often did they fill this plane on a, you know, on a 20 year cycle?
Sure. And so I don't think that data is public. Most airlines guard it very, very, very tightly. But one thing I'll throw out there that we have to be a little careful about is there's load factor is not a good proxy for profitability. It's easy to fill up an airplane.
right? Just charge less money.
No, yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm not even looking at it from a profitability standpoint. I'm looking at it more from Airbus's concept. And, you know, we put out this many seats, and over the course of 20 years, how many times could they have flown a smaller plane and still been okay? I'm not even looking at the profitability side, more just from curiosity of, if you literally could switch out the plane every single day, how many days did they really need the capacity of the A380? And how many days did they fly it because that was the plane that was there and they needed to fly the route and they didn't have a 787-9 that would have been, you know, a better fit size-wise for the day.
Yeah. I mean, I would argue that they would have just controlled the number of seats they sold by charging more for them. And so it was always the right plane in that context in some ways, but I see where you're coming from. But I think it's a little more complicated than that, unfortunately. And we're never going to have the data, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, it's really not from the airline standpoint. Yeah. It's more just, you know, Airbus said that they thought they'd have X number of instances where this was where you needed, call it 500 plus seats on a plane. How many days did we really need to move 500 from point A to point B?
No, that is definitely fair. And the only other thing I'll point out is that things like the Dallas to Sydney route that Qantas flies, and they fly it, you know, every day or 6 days a week, I forget which, but every day-ish. And it's been running for a few years now, and it's supposed to be one of their more profitable routes. Goes out with like 60 or 70 empty seats in coach most of the time.
Right.
And they block those seats because if they fill them, the plane will not make it all the way to Sydney. It is incredible aircraft that can go a very, very long way. And it turns out that route is very, 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 very long. So it comes up a little short if they fill all the seats, which is honestly, it's great for passengers. You have a much higher chance of an empty middle seat next to you in coach, but also, you know, it shows even with not selling some of the seats on a regular basis, they could make it a profitable aircraft because they sold enough of the rest of them. And there was the demand enough times for different cabins and that blend of, you know, whatever of, you know, premium mix and whatnot. So I don't know that full is always the right factor to consider. I do get where you're coming from of like, you know, if we only ever needed 300 seats, why are we buying a 400 seat plane?
Well, yeah, but I think in the example that you give there, and I don't remember how Qantas configures that A380 in terms of total number of seats, but, you know, losing 60 seats, there probably still isn't a plane on the market that would cover that route if they were filling everything minus 60.
Yeah, I think it would be a touch and go with the 747-8.
Yeah, exactly. I think I don't remember exactly how many seats they have in the plane, but I don't. It would definitely be a very full 748.
Yeah, and it would be a 748 that's very full and probably didn't have the same total floor space for premium seats, which is really what Qantas likes having available on that plane.
Exactly.
So.
Well, cool. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to digest it. I do love talking about this sort of stuff. I don't love necessarily seeing the A380 go away as an aviation geek, but, you know, we'll definitely see it flying around for quite a few more years. I would guess probably another 15 to 20 years.
I was going to sort of close with that as well. I think we're guaranteed to see it for another 10. After that, we'll see. I think that mid 2030s. Is probably where we'll start to see our late 2020s. We'll start to see some airlines retiring it. Mid 2030s, we'll see the end of it. I think honestly, it becomes an interesting question. And it depends on if there's a rebound in the secondary market. You know, we know HiFly took one and flew it for Norwegian and flew it for a couple other airlines as a charter plane. It hasn't gone anywhere in a couple months now, and that's not a good sign. It's also the winter, so it's low demand. For charter operations, but it's going to be real interesting to see if that secondary market picks up. If it doesn't, somewhere between 10 and 12 years out, after the planes come off lease, so the lessor has to find a new customer to pick it up, which is the HiFly situation, and B, there's a major maintenance cost that has to be incurred. And so if they don't, you know, you're only going to do that major maintenance check if there really is a reason to keep the plane flying. And it often involves not only major maintenance, but also engine refresh. So there's a, you know, 'cause engines don't last forever. You have to replace them every few thousand hours or several thousand hours. So there's going to be a situation at 10 to 12 years of life where every aircraft will be evaluated of, can this thing continue to make money? And that's going to start hitting us. You know, the last ones will be in 2020 or 2032-ish based on the deliveries plan for going through 2021.
Yeah, it's interesting because I would have pegged it more like 15 plus.
Yeah,
maybe not 20. I would peg it more like 15 plus. So I'll be interested to see. Can we schedule 2033 for you to be back on the podcast to see where we're at?
Yeah, just give me a date and a time. I'll throw it on my calendar, and then we'll, you know, rebook it 10 or 12 times because neither of us remembers how to use a calendar or talk or podcast or whatever else is going on at that time. Our holograms will talk to each other. How's that?
Exactly. Our holograms will have it programmed into their Google Glass by then. So folks, you know, mark it on your calendars. Seth will be back on in 2032 or 2033 to talk about the retirement of the last of the A380s.
From in flight, of course, because Wi-Fi on the planes will work much better then.
Still skeptical. Maybe not on United.
Come on. You're not going to take the bait?
All right. Well, when you're not gallivanting around Europe and hopping on the podcast with me, tell folks where they can find you and your podcast as well.
I am on the internet at PAXEX, PAXEX.AERO, and on Twitter at WANDRME. And then I also am Dots, Lines, and Destinations, which is at Dots, Lines on Twitter.
And every once in a while, he actually has me on the podcast, which is a bit of a scary thing. But you can find me there periodically playing the role of Foz.
There you go.
Safe travels, my friend. We'll talk soon.
Take care.
We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast. And it's time for our giveaway this week, sponsored by Bluffworks. They introduced a new item to their line of travel clothing recently, a pair of men's travel jeans. And I've been testing them out for a few weeks on a number of trips, and I really like them. They come out of my suitcase looking great, like all the Bluffworks stuff. And they've got a couple of safety security pockets with a theft-proof zipper on them to hide credit cards, cash, you know, passport, stuff like that. So they're definitely geared towards the traveler. They're available on their website now. You can get a 10% discount on a pair at bluffworks.com/pizza and use code pizza at checkout. But we're also giving away a pair courtesy of Bluffworks to one lucky winner. You'll find a blog post on my site with my review of the jeans and your way to enter. You'll need the secret phrase, which is pizza jeans. We got really creative on that one. Good luck. We'll announce our winner next week, and stay tuned for more giveaways on a Miles to Go podcast. Back on the Miles to Go podcast with Jen from Deals We Like. Hey, Jen, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, and we get to talk about my favorite hotel program this week because Hyatt has a promo out that, you know, maybe 5 years ago we wouldn't have said, wow, this is awesome. But, you know, certainly does feel like a leader in hotel promos that are out in the market right now. I'd say between this and the Hilton promo that you and I talked about a few weeks ago, these to me are the two strongest promotions out there right now.
I agree. I was anxiously waiting for a Hyatt promotion because we had not yet seen one in 2019. So when I got that email about a new promotion, I was very excited, and I was hoping that they would, you know, have something coming forward soon. And you know, I was pleasantly surprised. Like you said, there's no more fast or free nights anymore, and the good old days are over. But it's still a decent promotion. You know, I'll take it.
Yeah, and I would say specifically with this one, it's one of the first I've seen in a while that, you know, I would say I recommend to folks that they could potentially be worth it to move business for, in that I wouldn't say if you can only maximize the first part, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. So
yes, let me get into the promotion, I guess.
Yeah. Go through the two parts of the promotion for folks.
Absolutely. So between now, or actually February 15th and mid-May, May 15th, you'll earn up to 1,500 points for every single night at a Hyatt hotel. So you'll earn 1,000 points if you're staying at a regular Hyatt and Andaz, kind of more of your resort properties, your big city properties. And then if you're staying at a Hyatt House or a Hyatt Place, one of their lower level extended stay type of properties, you'll earn an additional 500 bonus points. So that's where you get the up to 1,500 point promotion. And it's decent. I mean, it's per night, so it's not per stay. So, you know, I hate those promotions where if you stay seven nights, you get the same amount of bonus points as if you stay two nights. So I like that. It, you know, you don't have to hotel hop. You don't have to stay at one hotel one night, one hotel the other night. I make my husband do that quite often, so he'll really enjoy this promotion. The only one negative thing with this promotion is that it doesn't start till your second stay. So the promotion started on February 15th. And on February 15th, I was checking into my Hyatt for a four-night stay. And unfortunately, I know. And unfortunately, those four nights did not count because it was booked as one single stay. And that was 4,000 points that I could have earned if it didn't have that second stay criteria. So that's the one negative. Although many hotel chains are doing that, many promotions require you because they're kind of looking for those customers that are continuously staying, not just those customers that have like a one-time Hyatt stay in a few months. So that's the one bummer. I was really disappointed. I was so excited when I saw a promotion coming out and I actually had a Hyatt stay that day, but I did not qualify.
Yeah, I do think that's a bummer. It's sort of like something that they caught contagious from the SPG Marriott world that sort of started at SPG with the, with the excluding the first stay, if you will. But, and I would say, as I mentioned earlier, 1,000 Hyatt points probably isn't worth as a bonus, probably isn't worth it for me to switch properties over something else if it was a more convenient, say, Hilton or Marriott or SPG property. But I would say if you're targeting a limited service hotel, if you're going to be staying at the equivalent of a Hyatt Place or a Hyatt House, if you were thinking about a Hampton Inn down the road or a Holiday Inn Express or something like that, I would, again, unless logistics were a big problem, I would absolutely consider moving business for 1,500 points a night, especially on something like you talked about, a four-night stay where you pick up an extra 1,500 points a night on your quote-unquote second stay.
Right.
6,000 points is halfway to a Category 4 free night. Like, that's great.
Right, especially at your Hyatt House and Hyatt Place properties. Those are typically your lower-cost properties. So many times you can get one of those for, $89. So the amount of bonus points you're earning is actually very high compared to the cost you're spending on that property, which is nice.
Yeah, for sure. And I think this is a great reminder for folks that not all points are created equal. And so, the top tier Hyatt properties are, 20 and 30,000 points a night, whereas the top tier Marriott properties are 60, 70, 80,000 points a night, and then potentially higher with some of the changes on peak and off peak. So 1,500 Hyatt points goes a lot further than 1,500 Marriott Bonvoy-ish points.
Right. I'd say it's equivalent to like 4,500 Marriott Bonvoy points, and you're not going to get that with the current Marriott promo going on.
No, I don't think so. So, I mean, it's a nice promo if you're staying at full service hotels, small luxury hotels of the world, the MGM properties in Las Vegas. I think those are, nice bonuses because, if you're going to stay there anyway. And then where I think the promo really turbocharges is if you're planning on limited service and can take advantage of the Hyatt Place and the Hyatt Hotels footprint.
Right. And also one thing is that's really good about this promotion. I like that chain hotels are actually moving towards this, but even on a stay using points or points plus cash, you'll still earn the bonus points. It doesn't just have to be a revenue stay. So that's one nice thing. You can kind of take that into consideration if you're using points. Well, you can deduct the points that you're actually going to be earning from the bonus, and maybe that will, mean that it's worth staying at that property versus another property.
No, you bring up a good point that we should have talked about, which is that this is essentially a rebate on award stays for this time period. So lots of benefits in this promo. Definitely my leader so far for 2019. Jen, thanks a bunch for being on the show. Tell folks where they can find you when you're not on the podcast with me.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me again. You can find me at my blog, dealswelike.com, and then also anything via social media at dealswelike. So Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Send me an email, dealswelike@gmail.com. Pretty much anything dealswelike related, you'll find me, and feel free to reach out.
Thanks a bunch, Jen. Safe travels. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Sad.
We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast. Back to wrap up this week's show on the final two pennies with tips that are probably a reminder for most of you, but just in case. And that's to make sure that you're signing up for airlines newsletters. Why? Well, the story that I'll tell goes back to the days of Virgin America before they went away. And back then, Virgin America used to have a route out of my hometown of Dulles to Los Angeles, LAX. And they frequently put that route on sale for, you know, super cheap prices. Now, I didn't fly Virgin America much. Now, I did like their first class product, but I wanted my loyalty points from American or United or whoever. But the interesting thing is that airlines do a pretty good job of matching each other's fares. So when Virgin America had a fare sale, it usually meant that American and United discounted some portion of their seats on the Dulles LAX route, which is one that I use for both business and pleasure. So knowing about those fare sales saved me a lot of money over the years, even though I never really was going to fly Virgin. So if there's an airline that flies out of your home airport, you want to be on their newsletter just in case a fare sale pops up that you can use from them, but also as a good way to check and see if your favorite airline is matching that sale as well. That's a full wrap on this week's episode. If there's a guest that you'd like to see appear on the show or questions that I can help answer, please let us know. If you can shoot me an email at ed@pizzainmotion.com or hit me up on Twitter or Facebook, Pizza in Motion. One last thing, we've got a new way to submit questions as well. There's an orange tab on our website, milestogo.boardingarea.com, where you can send us a voicemail, and we'll read that on a future show and get you an answer to your question. As always, thanks for listening again this week, and a big thanks to Seth and Jen for helping put together a great show. Finally, thanks to Mike LaRosa, our producer, for helping me publish another great show this week. You can find him at coworkaholic.com. We're already working on next week's show, but until then, we've got miles to go.